The 14th and 15th century saw a rise of contrasting new movements within the church. On one hand, mysticism was driven by the heart rather than the head. On the other hand, the Renaissance trusted in the ancient writings for truth. That's our focus next on Renewing Your Mind. We see these two schools of thought battling each other today, don't we? Experience and emotion versus intellectual pursuit. We thank you for joining us on this Saturday edition of Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. As we continue our survey of church history, we find that there really is nothing new under the sun. Dr. W. Robert Godfrey is our teacher for this series, and he's a Ligonier Teaching Fellow, as well as President Emeritus of Westminster Seminary, California. For the past several weeks, we have concentrated on the Middle Ages, and today we wrap up the 14th and 15th centuries with a lesson titled Mysticism and the Renaissance. Here's Dr. Godfrey.
When we looked at the theology of the latter part of the Middle Ages, we saw what an energetic, creative enterprise it was and how complicated, how difficult it was. Theology was a pathway to God, but it was not an easy path, and it was not a path that was open necessarily to all Christians. And what I want to talk about just briefly at the beginning of this lecture is the other path to God. I've alluded to it briefly in passing as we went along, the path of what is called mysticism. Thomas Aquinas is actually a very interesting illustration of this desire for another approach to God, because when Thomas was about 45, 46, he only lived to be 49, he recorded that while he was celebrating at Mass, he had a mystical experience. And he came away from that saying, I can write no more. I have seen things which make all my writings like straw. And what had happened is that he had some kind of experience, direct, personal experience with God. And this is what the mystics had regularly been seeking, a connection of the soul to God, a fellowship of the soul with God that transcended the mind, that transcended theological categories, and was something that attracted a number of Christians in the Middle Ages. Again, not so much the common people, but frequently those in the monasteries were looking for a mystical connection to God. And this mysticism rested on a rather intriguing understanding of theological anthropology, an understanding of how people functioned. And what they said is you can imagine human beings as sort of a circle, and on the outer layer of circles, we know things as human beings through our senses. But of course, the senses don't get you very far. The senses don't get you to what's really important in life, the theologian said. And so inside, there is a smaller but more important circle that allows us to reason and to will. And theology, as the scholastics did it, was built out of our ability to reason and to will. And this is crucial. This was God-given. It's of great value. But there's something else. This actually goes all the way back to Plato. At the very center of who we are as human beings, there is another faculty. There is another ability that we have that was called the synteresis. And this is the heart of us. This is the conscience deep within us. And this faculty, this ability, allows us to connect directly with God. Not mediated by our senses, not mediated by our reason, but a connection of soul to the Spirit of God. And this is what the mystics longed for. And this is what various mystics taught could be cultivated. It was possible that this just didn't happen as a surprise, but this could happen as a result of careful emptying of yourself to be open to God. And the great authority on this in the Middle Ages was a mystic known to history as Dionysius the Areopagite. Do you remember Dionysius the Areopagite? Dionysius was an Athenian whom Paul met in Athens and is mentioned very briefly in the book of Acts. But around the year 6, maybe 100, a little later, there suddenly appeared a collection of works that claimed to have been written by Dionysius the Areopagite. Historians now refer to this fellow as Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite. We do that just to show off. It's not the real Dionysius, but it was a forged document claiming to be written by Dionysius. And it took on great authority in the Middle Ages because medieval theologians believed it was really written by the friend of Paul. And if it was written by the friend of Paul, he must have known the mind of Paul, right? This must be a really reliable guide to things. And what Dionysius did in his writing was to lay out a pathway of gradually purging away the sensations of the body that distract us, purging away reason, which can limit us, and allowing the divine light to come and illumine us so that the syntheresis, like a spark, can connect to God. That was the kind of language that was used. It was often poetic language to talk about the way in which the soul could unite with God. And that was the great aim. And many theologians in the Middle Ages, to one extent or another, encouraged this direction of theology, this, we would say, cultivation of devotion, because in many ways it was a sort of cultivation of devotion. But it always had a dangerous tendency. And the dangerous tendency that you could see already in Dionysius himself, but even later in the famous German mystic Meister Eckhart, I don't know why in English we always insist on calling him Meister Eckhart. Meister just means master, the master theologian Eckhart, who was roughly a contemporary with William of Ockham and some of the medieval nominalists in the early 14th century. What comes up pretty clearly in Eckhart is his desire is that he might be lost in the divine, that he might recognize he's only part of the divine. And this tendency in mysticism is the pantheistic tendency. God is everything, and therefore I am God, and what I'm longing for is my reconnection with God, to realize my connection with God. If you turn on PBS and listen to Wayne Dyer, it's just a modern version of Meister Eckhart with the Christian trappings stripped away. I don't know why it's all right to have pantheistic religion on public television. But anyway, that's an issue for another day. But this was what the church constantly worried about, that this mysticism, while in some ways promoting spirituality, promoting piety, would lead in a dangerous pantheistic direction. It didn't always. And there were forms of mysticism in a document like the Theologia Germanica, the German theology, a late medieval mystic work that mainly just stressed humility, emptying yourself of ambition and of pride, opening yourself up to God. And a work like that actually had quite an influence in the early days on Luther. So that kind of encouragement to piety was not altogether a bad thing. So this is just another indication of how rich and varied thought was in the Middle Ages. We've been able to just sort of scratch the surface of what we've been looking at, and this mysticism was a whole nother important part of that tradition and of that development. And it continues to have an influence today. You can continue to see in much of the New Age movement this same kind of pantheizing mysticism present. Now, another major intellectual development in the late Middle Ages, or some would say the early modern period, was the rise of what we call the Renaissance. The Renaissance, the word simply means the rebirth, and it expressed a profound sense that Europe was entering into a new phase, that there was a new educational opportunity arising of great importance, and the Renaissance was going to be sort of the wave of the future. The Renaissance was a movement whose recurring cry and emphasis was ad fontes, to the sources. And what the Renaissance wanted to do was to get back behind the Middle Ages, ad fontes really means to the fountains, literally to the fountains or to the sources. And what the Renaissance said, you know, all of this medieval stuff is okay, but it's not as good as ancient thought. It's all just been, you know, reflecting on ancient thought, but also distorting ancient thought. Westerners were smarter and better in the ancient world than they've ever been in the medieval world. And we can see that very simply if you read a scholastic like Thomas Aquinas and compare that with reading Cicero. Now, nowadays, we don't read Cicero much, but in the beginnings of the Renaissance, they compared the kind of wooden Latin of Thomas Aquinas with the beautiful, eloquent, powerful style of Cicero as a writer. And they look at the difference between this. The one is so mechanical, so sort of brutal and jarring and lacking in any sort of eloquence. And the other is so moving in its style. That's the contrast between the beauties of the ancient world and the sort of debased character of the Middle Ages. We need a rebirth of learning. We need to get back behind this medieval stuff to the glories of the ancient world. And so the initial move of the early Renaissance thinkers was to go back and read Cicero and discover the glories of really elegant Latin. An early Renaissance thinker who was encouraging this line of thought was an Italian by the name of Petrarch. He got sharply attacked by the scholastics. Who does this fellow Petrarch think he is? To criticize us and to think he knows so much. What does he know? He doesn't know anything. He doesn't know any theology. And that led Petrarch to write a great essay entitled On His Own Ignorance and That of Many Others. And he just savaged the scholastics for their claim to learning when he believed they didn't know anything. Now, this is a sort of classic conflict of philosophies, of cultures, of ideals. The scholastics knew a lot, but they didn't care about elegant writing. They didn't care about beautiful style in writing. But now suddenly the sort of mood is changing in Europe, and there's this desire to get back to the ancient world and its strengths and its glories. And then Renaissance scholars began to say, well, you know, if the ancient Latin world is so great, what must the ancient Greek world be like? And very few people in Western Europe could read Greek. It was a skill that had almost been lost in Western Europe in the Middle Ages. But now scholars began to long to be able to read Greek and tried to teach themselves Greek, and then something happened very important. 1453, Constantinople fell to the Turks, and all sorts of Greek scholars brought Greek books to Italy and to Western Europe. This didn't begin the interest in Greek, but it greatly advanced the ability to study Greek, to possess Greek texts. And soon they were saying, wow, look at the way Plato wrote. Look the way Demosthenes wrote. This is all so much more beautiful, so much more elegant, so much more intellectually compelling than all that we've had in the Middle Ages. This is a new age. This is a new era. We're going to go places no one has ever gone before with this learning. And it really was a dramatic and significant turning point in Western culture. And we might say, you know, isn't this really kind of surprising? a change really of curriculum so that now we're reading different authors, we're learning different languages can make such a difference. But it did, because this became the new ideal. This became what was critically important. And an educated man by the end of the 15th century, and of course there were very few of them, but an educated man by the end of the 15th century was said to be a man of three languages, a man who knew Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Now, the revival in the 15th century of a knowledge of Greek and Hebrew, you see, is not a bad preparation for the coming of the Reformation. Because part of what happens when people are now able, or at least a few people are now able to read Greek and to read Hebrew, is that they can go back and look at the Bible in its original form and ask the question, has the church been interpreting the Bible really correctly? That was not the initial motive of the early Renaissance scholars, but it produced a foundation which allowed an explosion of biblical studies and scholarship in the 16th century. Another thing in the providence of God that happened very close to the time of the fall of Constantinople was the development of the printing press. And again, it's hard to overstate the importance of the printing press to the development of the modern Western world. Books in the medieval period and in the ancient period were an exceedingly rare and exceedingly expensive proposition. You know, we go home and probably on any number of shelves in our homes have Bibles, and we take having a Bible so for granted. If you would only have a Bible in terms of what you had copied by hand, you would be in a very different position, wouldn't you? Especially when you realize that in the Middle Ages, most common people were not taught to read. Even many nobles couldn't read. They said, what's the point? I can hire somebody who can read. There are a dime a dozen. It was a very small scholarly community that was able to read. And now, all of a sudden, in the providence of God, there's this opportunity to have a wholly new kind of education and a wholly new approach to be able to possess books and to be able to read things that were never read before. And so in the late 15th on the early 16th century, all of a sudden, all sorts of church fathers were being printed, like Augustine, who'd never really been available to lots of people before. And again, people were able to read Augustine and say, now, wait a minute. What Augustine's saying isn't what we're hearing most of the time in church. And then Greek fathers were being printed, Chrysostom and other Greek fathers, so that people were able to see what the ancient Greeks thought in the church. And again, there was a sense there's distance here between what we're experiencing and what we're reading in these authors. And then even with the study of Hebrew. And this became the standard of the educated person, a standard that dominated Western education until well into the 20th century. I was just reading a biography of an Englishman who went to Oxford in the 1920s. And what did he do in high school? He mainly studied Latin and Greek. And when he got to Oxford, a friend of his was chosen to deliver the annual Bodleian Oration, which was one of the greatest honors could be conferred on an undergraduate at Oxford, to address the whole university in a speech. But the speech had to be delivered in Latin. 1930s. So this young man went to the fellow whose biography was reading, Hugh Trevor Roper, and said, could you help me with my speech? My Latin's pretty good, but I could use a little help. And so they worked on it together, and the young man delivered the speech, and many people came out saying, that was the wittiest oration we've had in years. 1930s, there were still enough people at Oxford that they could attend a lecture in Latin and come away commenting on the jokes and on the style. That's the Renaissance. That's this ideal of beautiful language, of being able to read ancient texts, of having the soul and the mind fed by the ancients. And that study was put to very practical use. There was a Renaissance scholar in the middle of the 15th century in Italy by the name of Lorenzo Valla. And Valla studied the Donation of Constantine, this document that claims to have given the whole Western Empire to the Pope by the Emperor Constantine. Valla reads it and says, this isn't written in 4th century Latin. This is written in 7th century Latin. And he was able to prove that the Donation of Constantine, the foundation of the Pope's claims to authority in the West, was a forgery. And so this came to be very practical learning that the church could see had potentially very destructive effects on the theology, the authority, the position of the church. And then this Renaissance learning, which began in Italy, began to move north. And the great Renaissance scholar of the north was Desiderius Erasmus. And some of us remember Erasmus only because of a debate he had with Luther. But the great accomplishment of Erasmus was to provide a new translation of the Bible from Greek into Latin. He published a critical Greek text of the New Testament and next to it a fresh Latin translation of the New Testament. And this was revolutionary. The church had really never thought about a new translation of the New Testament for over 1,000 years, going back to when Jerome had translated the New Testament from Greek into Latin. And suddenly things came alive that had never been clear before. So that the Latin text that had always been used to defend the doctrine of penance, the sacrament of penance, in Latin, according to Jerome, it said, do penance. Well, there you have it. Jesus says, do penance. That's the foundation for the sacrament of penance. And then people could read Greek in the new Latin translation. Said, wait a minute, it doesn't say do penance. It says repent. These are very different things. And Erasmus faced some difficult questions. Jerome had written, in principio erat verbum, in the beginning was the word. And Erasmus says, you know, logos isn't really just a word, it's a message, it's a communication. And so he wanted to write, in principio erat oratio. In the beginning was the oration. But translation's tricky. He says to himself, now wait a minute, oratio is a feminine noun. If I translate the eternal second person of the Trinity as a feminine noun, I may get in trouble with the gender police. So he translated it, in principio erat sermo. In the beginning was the sermon. In the beginning was the more informal communication from God. But stressing that in the beginning was a message, not just a discrete word. And in that, in so many other ways, the Bible began to come alive in a way that people had never sensed before, had never understood before. And so this new learning, as it was known, this rebirth of learning, sometimes was unnecessarily critical of scholasticism, sometimes dismissed it in ways that weren't really correct, but did sense that somehow they were able to peel away centuries of tradition, centuries of assumptions, and begin to get scholars, at least initially, back to the Bible and back to the earliest sources of the church and give opportunity for a whole new way of looking at things. So we can see how varied, how amazing the developments of this rich period of 1,000 years in Christian civilization really was. All of the different ideas, all of the different activities that came out of here, and what a long shadow they have cast on our experience as Christians and on Western civilization.
That's Dr. Robert Godfrey as he continues his series, A Survey of Church History, here on the Saturday edition of Renewing Your Mind. Over the past several weeks, Dr. Godfrey has taken us from the apostolic era through the Middle Ages. And as we continue the 73 lessons in this series, he'll take us right up to the present day. We do see the profound influence, don't we, that these ancient thinkers have had on Christian thought. Dr. Godfrey's series is on 12 DVDs, and it's available to you for your gift of any amount today. Make your request at renewingyourmind.org or simply call us at 800-435-4343. We see such a contrast between the mystics and those who were influenced by the Renaissance, and we're thankful for Dr. Godfrey as he helps us put these movements into biblical perspective. Again, for your gift of any amount, we'll send you this 12 DVD set, 73 lessons. Our phone number is 800-435-4343, or you can make your request and give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. Before we go today, let me remind you about our 24-hour internet radio station. It's called RefNet. You'll hear trusted teaching from pastors and theologians like Drs. Stephen Lawson, Alistair Begg, John MacArthur, Albert Mohler, and others. It's always free. Just go to refnet.fm, or you can download the free RefNet app and listen on your phone. Well, next weekend, we move from the Middle Ages and enter the period of the Protestant Reformation. We hope you'll join us next Saturday for Renewing Your Mind.